Cracks in the foundation. Cracks in the foundation. From the outside, it looked like we had finally made it. A new house, a blended family, a fresh start. But behind the front door, the truth was harder to ignore. Old scars don't heal just because you change the scenery, and the deeper you bury the cracks, the louder they eventually roar. But even with Diane's house finally sold and all of us living under one roof, the cracks that had started to show between us didn't magically disappear. If anything, the pressure only grew heavier. Blending two families wasn't just a logistical challenge, it was an emotional minefield. Old wounds, different parenting styles, unspoken resentments, they all simmered just beneath the surface, needing only the smallest spark to ignite. I had believed, perhaps naively, that a fresh house meant a fresh start. That we could leave the heartache, doubts, and broken promises behind us. But a house, no matter how big or full of potential, can't fix what's broken between people. It only gives you more rooms to retreat into when things start to fall apart. Despite everything I had sacrificed to get us here, selling my house, uprooting my sons, taking a leap of faith, I could already feel it. The foundation beneath us wasn't solid. It was crumbling, and none of us were brave enough yet to admit it. One of the biggest challenges lay with Remy. He struggled most with Diane's arrival and the changes it brought. For years after his mother's death, Remy had been quietly influential over how we lived our lives. Thanks to his wide social circle, Old Road had turned into a kind of unofficial youth club. The dining room became a snooker room, a dartboard was put up in the kitchen, and our house became an open door to his friends. Wednesday nights became known as Orange Wednesdays, where Remy would invite his friends over to watch films, play music, dress up in costumes, and generally turn the house into a noisy, lively haven. Josh and I would stay out of their way. I didn't mind. As long as my sons were happy, so was I. But when Diane started staying over at weekends, a lot of that open house atmosphere had to stop, or at least be scaled back. There were too many nights when Orange Wednesdays ended in drunken chaos and broken furniture. Diane rightly would put a stop to it, insisting that boundaries had to be set. Remy didn't accept that. The resentment simmered, adding to the growing tension between them. Back in 2006, when Remy turned 18, I had tried to make up for the loss of his old freedoms. I paid for him and Ben to go on holiday to Ayia Napa in Cyprus, a gift to celebrate his adulthood. As a bit of a joke, Diane and I also arranged for Caitlin, who had just turned 18 herself that May, to surprise them by booking her into the same hotel. I even left a fake note for Remy and Ben at reception, telling them Diane and I were holidaying nearby and would meet them at the Queen Vic pub, a panic-inducing prospect for two lads wanting independence. It backfired slightly. Thinking I was nearby, Remy ramped up his room service spending, expecting me to bail him out, only to find out we weren't there at all. Shortly after that summer, Remy headed north to Edge Hill University in Ormskirk to study media. He had already earned his place at the Brit School earlier, and studying film and media seemed a natural progression. I helped him move, driving up in my car packed with everything Diane had thoughtfully gathered for him. Pots, pans, a Hoover, and all the small essentials a young man would need in his digs. Josh came with me, and Remy followed in his Renault Clio, the same car he had bought with me after passing his driving test on his first attempt before he even turned 18. I had taught him myself, despite a few painfully testing lessons. Once up north, Remy quickly got swept into the student lifestyle. One of his friends, Chris Peacock, had also moved to Liverpool University and was deep into fresher celebrations. Naturally, Remy joined him, and I found myself booking into a nearby Premier Inn with Josh for the night, waiting for him to surface. True to form, we didn't hear from him until late the next afternoon. Completely hungover and oblivious to the fact that Josh and I had sacrificed our time to help him settle in. Sadly, the pattern continued. Remy spent more time partying than studying. In his second year, moving off campus into a rented house with friends only fueled the behavior. There was even a disastrous house party where what felt like half of South London descended on Ormskirk, leading to damages, complaints, and an angry landlord demanding repairs, with me, as guarantor, left to foot the bill. Diane made her feelings clear, not just to me, but to Remy too. She was disgusted by the disrespect and the irresponsibility, and it only deepened the rift between them. By the third year, Remy came back to me asking if he could extend his studies for another year. He said he wanted to push for a 2-to-1 instead of a 2-to-2. I agreed, only to later discover that he hadn't been honest. He had already been kicked out due to failed attendance. He simply wanted to carry on living the party life. Even before university, Remy and Ben had discovered a love for festivals. My old friend Mike Croft and his wife Maxine had launched their own festival, Hope, in May, a perfect preseason event before Glastonbury Download and Latitude kicked off. That first taste led to many adventures. Remy, Ben, and their mate Patty even tried once to sneak into Glastonbury by scaling fences with grappling hooks while dressed head to toe in camouflage. Needless to say, they failed spectacularly. I remember hearing, years after the fact, that during one Glastonbury trip, Remy's friends had found a way to cover all their expenses. They bought large quantities of aspirin, ground them down into powder, and bagged them into tiny cellophane packets to sell. When I found out, I was mortified. But if I'm being honest, a small part of me couldn't help but admire their ingenuity. And so the pattern was set. A thirst for adventure, a flair for chaos, and a heart that too often let recklessness win out over responsibility. After university, Remy moved back home. Both Caitlin and Ben were already working regularly at the cafe. By 2005, we were now settled into our new house in Grove Park, and although I still had access to funds from the drawdown on my flat, it had become clear that Diane and I weren't going to pursue the property portfolio we had once planned. Around the same time, the insurance claim for the wall damage was settled at around £17,000, with payment imminent. The cafe was doing well, but its setup was still relatively basic. I wanted to raise the bar, both in decor and in what we offered, and return to the style of the delicatessen we had run all those years ago during our Greenwich days. Needing to move quickly, we found a local Polish builder named Artuk and his two trusted friends, Radok and John. Normally, I would have used my old go-to team, Martin and Fred, but time was of the essence. With a quote we were happy with, along with support from a Polish cabinet company based in Deptford, Diane and I began designing the new layout, complete with custom cabinets and pull-down shutters. Artuk and his team got to work, and soon the cafe had a fresh new look and a brand new energy. I reintroduced a range of delicatessen products, including a 2-year farmhouse cheddar, Shropshire Blue, Brie de Meaux, premium Italian pasta from Pasta Reale, and gourmet baby food from Truly Scrumptious. My personal favorite was the collection of artisanal olive oils and vinegars, fig-infused balsamic, garlic olive oil, and more, all displayed in large glass bottles fitted with taps. Customers could buy pretty refillable glass bottles and return whenever they wished to top them up. Caitlin even launched her own little venture on farmers market days. I had introduced her to William Santos & Co., the makers of Uncle Joe's Mint Balls, a traditional sweet company founded in Wigan in 1898, still run by the family generations later. Uncle Joe's produced classic sweets with no artificial additives, gluten-free and vegan-friendly. Mint balls, rhubarb and custards, aniseed balls, cough candy twists, and more. We stocked them in traditional glass jars and sold them by weight, creating a nostalgic sweet shop feel. We also introduced products from the original Candy Co., specialists in natural ingredient candy canes, sticks, and bespoke sweets, bringing a colorful artisan touch to our shelves. The cafe wasn't just transformed, it flourished. Alongside the new retail offerings, I expanded the menu to include sweet and savory crepes, along with our popular sandwiches. Within a year, turnover had tripled to more than £200,000 per annum. The dream of blending the warmth of a family-run deli with the buzz of a thriving cafe was finally becoming a reality. With Remy back living at home, Diane decided it was time to lay down some ground rules. Remy was pushing 21, as was Caitlin, and Ben was already 22. All technically adults, but still under our roof. Diane made it clear, if they were in serious, established relationships, ones where we'd been properly introduced to their partners, we were happy for them to stay over. Ben was already with Jenny, a lovely girl who worked at the cafe, and Caitlin was seeing a decent lad, both relationships we approved of. But casual flings and one-night stands, That was a line we weren't willing to cross. The rules seemed clear enough. At least, we thought they were. Not long after setting the rules, Remy and Ben went out partying in New Cross. Early the next morning, Diane and I were downstairs having breakfast when we heard footsteps in the hall. Out of Remy's room strolled a pretty young blonde, wearing nothing but boxer shorts and one of Remy's t-shirts. She smiled, chirped a cheerful good morning to us, and then, to our complete astonishment, wandered upstairs into Ben's room. Diane and I just stared at each other, stunned. We had never seen this girl before. I went into Remy's room to find out what on earth was going on. In his room, Joe Beswick, a local lad and old friend whose dad and I had once coached kids squash with at Woolwich Sports Center, was flat out on the floor, dead to the world. Remy himself was fast asleep, too. I shook Remy awake and asked him directly who the girl was. Groggy and defensive, he insisted he had no idea, said she was Ben's friend who had crashed in his room. When we confronted Ben, he stuck to the same story. He didn't know her either, though her handbag was now lying on the floor of his room. Diane, fed up with the nonsense, decided to ask the girl herself. The truth turned out worse than expected. They'd all been out drinking, met the girl at the tail end of the night, and somehow she'd tagged along home with them, a complete stranger. Remy had brought her into his room, and after some drunken fooling around had kicked her out of bed. Confused, embarrassed, and still half-drunk, she had wandered upstairs and climbed into bed next to a fast-asleep Ben, who didn't even realize she was there until morning. It was chaos, funny in hindsight maybe, but at the time a brutal reminder of how much trouble alcohol, immaturity, and poor judgment could cause under our roof. It also made something very clear: no matter what ground rules we laid down, Remy would find ways to break them, especially if they didn't fit his version of life. In a strange way, I admired his stubbornness, his refusal to be boxed in. But it didn't change the fact that tensions in the house were growing. Diane and I generally got on well, we rarely argued, but when it came to her clashing with my sons, especially Remy, it always led to major fallouts between us. I felt torn, caught between my loyalty to my children and my commitment to Diane. Another flashpoint came when we realized that Remy's friend, Joe Hurley, was secretly staying over most nights. Remy would wait until we were asleep, then sneak Joe through his bedroom window. It turned out Joe had nowhere else to go. His mother had remarried and moved away, taking his little brother with her and leaving Joe effectively homeless. Rather than throw him out, we offered him a proper place to stay, converting the upstairs study into a makeshift bedroom for him. When Joe turned 21, we bought him a laptop as a birthday present, only to find out later that he sold it to fund a growing drug habit. Despite the ongoing battles between Diane and Remy, she agreed to help throw a full-blown birthday party for Remy and Caitlin. We rented a bucking bronco under a marquee in the garden, surrounded by an inflatable bed for safety. All their friends turned up, and it was a wild night of drinking, laughter, and chaos. Caitlin, true to form, was proudly shouting her catchphrase, "Eating is cheating," as food was left largely untouched in favor of endless rounds of drinks. It was a brilliant night in many ways, but beneath the laughter and celebration, the cracks in our household were starting to widen.